From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Landmines placed in time of war continue to maim and kill civilians long after the conflict is over. There are close to 100 million landmines in place around the world. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Eric Stover, Executive Director of Physicians for Human Rights, which is calling for a ban on these weapons. Stover conducted a study of the medical and social consequences of landmines in Cambodia. Also, we meet writer E. Annie Prue. She won two of the literary world's biggest prizes this year, the Penn Faulkner Award and the National Book Award. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews Fox's new hit show for children, Mighty Morphin Power Rangers. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton has nominated retired Navy Admiral Bobby Ray Inman to be his second Secretary of Defense. If confirmed by the Senate, Inman would replace Les Aspin, who announced his resignation yesterday. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Appearing in the Rose Garden, Mr. Clinton said Inman will be a national asset as defense secretary, praising his brains, his talent, and his hard work. For his part, Inman, the former number two man at the CIA and most recently a private businessman, stressed his independence. He noted he had not wanted the job as defense secretary and had voted for President Bush rather than Mr. Clinton.
Mr. President, as you know, I had to reach a level of comfort that we could work together, that I would be very comfortable in your role as the Commander-in-Chief, President, while I was Secretary of Defense. And I have found that level of comfort.
Inman is highly regarded by lawmakers of both parties and is expected to win easy confirmation by the Senate. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
American attorneys for two Libyans suspected in the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 said today that the case is politically motivated and should be dismissed. Frank Rubino and John Mayer defending the two Libyans in a case filed in U.S. District Court. The two suspects are still in Libya, where the government of Muammar Gaddafi has refused to extradite them. The United Nations has imposed economic sanctions on Libya, but has so far failed to force the Libyans to comply. The defense lawyer said the case against the Libyans is a cover-up to hide the responsibility of Syria and Iran for the bombing. The Illinois Supreme Court has decided against taking any action in the case of a pregnant woman the state wanted to force to have a cesarean. NPR's Jackie Lydon has more.
Mother Doe, as she's known in court documents, is a 22-year-old religious fundamentalist who is 8 months pregnant and opposed to a cesarean. Doctors have determined her baby is suffering from oxygen deprivation and could be born dead or suffer severe retardation through normal vaginal delivery. The Cook County Public Guardian's office failed on Tuesday at the appellate court level to obtain an order to force the woman to have a cesarean section. In a two-sentence ruling today, the state Supreme Court decided against interfering with the woman, an action supported by the ACLU and medical ethicists. Cook County had argued that under Roe v. Wade, it had a legitimate interest in the third trimester unborn child. But now, said Patrick Murphy, who was appointed to represent the unborn baby, for the purposes of this fetus, the case is closed. I'm Jackie Lydon in Chicago.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 9 points to close at 3,726. Advances led declines by a slight margin in heavy trading of 284 million shares. This is NPR News. Federal health officials say there's no good excuse for the big increase in the number of American children who are coming down with whooping cough. As of early this month, the Centers for Disease Control reports nearly 5,500 cases of whooping cough this year. That's the highest number since 1967. The experts say that's because too many children aren't being vaccinated on time. They warn that whooping cough can lead to pneumonia, seizures, and inflammation of the brain. 1 in 10 public school teachers has been assaulted in and around his or her school, usually by a student. And almost a fourth of the students say they've been victims. This is according to a survey released today in Washington. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
The Metropolitan Life Insurance Company surveyed 1,000 public school teachers, 1,200 elementary and high school students, and 100 police department officials across the country last October, and found that a fifth of all students often worry about being physically attacked. Teachers worry even more. Assaults occur in hidden areas, such as bathrooms, and most often in locker rooms. The survey does not provide hard data about weapons, but 13% of the students interviewed said they have at some point carried a knife or gun to school. Of the police department officials surveyed, 41% believe weapons are now common on school campuses. Most, if not all, teachers who had been assaulted said they had reported the incident, but only one in four students ever reported acts of violence against them. I'm Claudio Sanchez in Washington.
A California grocery chain has agreed to pay up to $107 million to settle a case brought by women who claimed they were denied promotions because of their sex. The settlement is the second largest ever in a U.S. sex discrimination case. About 14,000 current and former women employees of Lucky Stores will share in the settlement. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Long after a war has ended, landmines remain in place, killing and maiming civilians. Landmines used to be defensive battlefield weapons, but now in many smaller conflicts and civil wars, landmines are used to terrorize civilians and control their movements. The Cambodian Civil War is believed to be the first conflict in which more civilians were killed by mines than by any other weapon. One Cambodian out of every 236 has lost a limb. My guest Eric Stover is the executive director of Physicians for Human Rights. He headed the first comprehensive study of the medical and social consequences of landmines in Cambodia. His group is calling for a global ban on the manufacture and export of landmines. Today, the UN General Assembly adopted a non-binding resolution banning the export of anti-personnel landmines. The Clinton administration supported the ban and urged other countries to support it as well. Stover was last in Cambodia investigating landmines in June.
They're everywhere in Cambodia and in other countries such as Angola and northern Somalia. I think one of the most devastating things about the indiscriminate use of landmines in Cambodia by all the factions in the civil war, which ended in 1991, was that they used them against the people. I mean, these mines were used not only to control land so people wouldn't get access to it, but also to control the movement of people. And we know one faction in particular, the Khmer Rouge, they specifically used mines to disrupt agriculture and transport, to sort of buckle the government at its knees. And finally, they used mines to terrorize the population. There are frequently cases where we heard, and there were witnesses to, where situations where the Khmer Rouge would surround a village and put mines around the village and then literally send artillery shells into the center of the village so people fled out through the minefields.
How are mine wounds different than other wounds?
Well, what we found in our trips to a number of hospitals throughout the world where there are landmine victims or patients is that you see that in gunshot wounds, while all physical trauma is terrible, the gunshot wounds and artillery wounds tend to be somewhat clear wounds. They penetrate through this tissue and exit, and they may leave some infection, but not a great amount compared to the type of wound that landmines cause. And the problem here is that anti-personnel mines are designed to maim, and they act on a pressure system where you step on the mine and it releases an explosion, which then drives not only the various parts of the mines, which may be metal fragments, or maybe if they're plastic coated, or soil and tissue, or splintered bone, but it is forced up into the leg or across the body. So you, when the patient is brought in to the hospital, number one, they're going to require traumatic, or they're going to require some sort of surgery, normally amputation. We find in comparison to other war-related wounds, that surgery is going to be more costly, it's going to take more time, it's going to require twice the amount of blood that other war wounds will require. And we also find that landmine patients stay in hospital longer and require more assistance than other victims of war wounds.
I know you did a survey of mine victims. in Cambodia. Were there typical stories of how civilians hit landmines?
What the patterns we saw were basically this, that many, what one has to understand in most of the countries infested with landmines, and particularly in Cambodia, is that these are developing agrarian, impoverished countries where you live by your muscle power. In Cambodia, for example, the rhythm of life is the rhythm of the rice culture. There's the flooding of the rice paddies, then there's the planting and the replanting and the harvesting. So in the family unit in the village, everyone needs to be out working in the fields. And what we found was, as people were wandering, whether they were going to work or whether young boys were taking their cattle out to graze, they were out collecting firewood, they would be they'd step on a mine and then either be killed. Many of them we know have been killed, and those that are fortunate enough make it to hospital. But what happens then, the effect is, once they're released from hospital and return to their families, many of them have now become a burden to their families because they can't go out and work any longer, or they can't work at the same rate they did before. I think one of the saddest things that I saw in Cambodia was a case in an area in Mongol Barai, which is heavily infested, and I became acquainted with a case there of a young child, no more than 7 years old, who had been playing near his village and stepped on a mine and was paraplegic as a result. And he was brought to the hospital by his family. He was treated as best he could. He would survive, but he would be paraplegic for the rest of his life. And the parents left him there, and they abandoned him at the hospital. The doctors didn't know what to do. For 3 or 4 months, the parents didn't return. Now, this is a sacrilege. Anyone who's been to a developing country, to abandon a child is a sacrilege. I mean, you do not do this. And in any culture, but particularly in the developing world. Well, finally, the family did return, but it just shows they didn't know what to do. They didn't know how they would provide for this child. So you get a sense of the devastation it caused.
Is there a growing part of the population now that is helpless because they are amputees and they're not able to get artificial limbs and adequate medical treatment?
Yes, very definitely. This is, again, the sort of multiplying effect of landmines. Not only do they put the stress on surgical care and extended time in hospital, but once the landmine victim leaves, they're going to require an artificial limb. And the problem is, in many of these countries, they're unable to produce enough limbs. And also, if you take, for example, a child of the age of 10, if that child steps on a mine, they're going to require an artificial limb. And then if that child lives to be 40 or 50 years old, he or she is going to need 25 artificial limbs, because you need to change them with the growth of the child. And if each of those limbs cost $125, that child in his or her lifetime will spend some $3,500 on artificial limbs, and may never make more than between $800 and $1,000 a year. So it's a tremendous stress, not only on the family, but on the economic situation in the country, of people going back to work when they can't, because they simply don't have the same possibilities they'd had before the injuries.
Do a lot of the landmine victims end up begging on the streets?
Oh, yes. It's one of the problems in Cambodia is many people, they find that they can't work in their villages, and particularly young men, and they drift to the city, and they take up begging. It's a problem in Phnom Penh, in the capital, where you see groups of soldiers who've lost limbs, who actually carry out petty thefts and so on. And everywhere you go, you'll see begging around all the rather expensive and posh hotels. There are landmine victims begging. I mean, it is something that you'll never forget, to see the extent that the damage that this weapon has caused.
What kind of precautions did you have to take as you traveled through Cambodia?
Well, our precautions are simply to know where we're going, to check ahead of time.
But if you know where you're going, but you don't know where the landmines are, how much of a help is that?
Well, I don't think I don't think that the real danger to us in actually going in, into the hospital, there's not really a danger there on the main roads. It's of course, there's always that problem. But once you get out into the countryside, then you're running into a situation where you'll never know where they are. I would mention, though, my organization, Physicians for Human Rights, has been working in Yugoslavia over the last year with the War Crimes Commission to carry out exhumations of the mass graves associated with war crimes there. And it's come home to us very clearly the menace of landmines in former Yugoslavia, because before we can go into any area to begin looking for these graves, which are, of course, unmarked, we have to have demining teams. And we'll be delayed days while they'll go in and simply go over with metal detectors to try and find landmines. We also know that the use of landmines in former Yugoslavia is one where they're being used to stop the flow of relief supplies and the movement of people out of conflict zones.
Which groups are most responsible for laying down the landmines?
That is, everyone gets to share, I think, in that particular nightmare. There's none, we have no evidence to show that anyone is doing more damage than others. The problem is, as in Cambodia and most ethnic conflicts and low-intensity civil conflicts, is you have a country riddled literally with ceasefire lines. And each pocket or area where there is a particular faction, they will then use mines to guard that area. And when they leave, they often don't pick them up. So it's every faction shares the blame in Yugoslavia and also in Cambodia. Although I think in Cambodia, clearly the manner in which the Khmer Rouge used landmines was to terrorize.
In the former Yugoslavia, is it similar to Cambodia in that the landmines are mostly in rural parts?
Oh, yes. They're clearly, in fact, more so. Well, they are very much like in Cambodia. I mean, they're scattered over rural areas. However, they tend, I don't think, at this point at least, we're not seeing the level of the high intensity of the problem in Yugoslavia like we've seen in Cambodia, because they are restricted to those ceasefire lines. Now, what the problem is that mines love movement, and the minute there is some sort of ceasefire and a peace agreement, you're going to have the mass movement of people, and that's where we're probably going to see the injuries among the civilian population rise considerably.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Eric Stover. He's the executive director of Physicians for Human Rights, which is calling for an international ban on the use of landmines. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Eric Stover, Executive Director of Physicians for Human Rights. We're talking about landmines. His group is calling for an international ban on their use. How visible is a landmine once it's been set? And I wonder if any of your travels you have come across one that's been sitting there waiting for somebody to step on it.
Well, probably the most vivid example was last June when I was in Cambodia, and along the one highway, which one runs through the country, which is in many parts, most of it is just simply a dirt road. Along the bridges, there are still government troops that are there, and they put out mines every evening. And as we were driving through over one bridge, we stopped and started talking to some of the soldiers about their mine. Did they use mines? And they took us over and pointed to a pile, literally, of PMN, which are a Soviet-made mine, that are a little bigger than a hockey puck. And these are very common throughout Cambodia. Now, these were sitting right off to the right side of the road, and they were in a cluster of about four or five. There was not a soldier within 30 yards of where they were sitting. And as we stood there talking to them, they were picking them up and showing them to us. And these were, had been activated. You can pick them up as long as you don't hit the pressure plate. And then they would set them down. And as we walked away, we watched as children and dogs literally ran by these mines along the road. And all one of them had to do is take a step a yard to the right, and they would have been blown up. Also, they pointed out to us where they had put out trip wires in the evenings or for nighttime so there wouldn't be access. And they told us that there had been at least one person killed within the last month. Another incident that was particularly alarming, and it'll give you an idea of how durable these landmines are. The end of my trip in June, I went to visit the head of the UN demining effort there, a major with the New Zealand Army, and he had on his desk a fragment of a anti-personnel mine, which is a type of mine that are called scatterables. They actually can be dropped from aircraft and do not detonate when they hit the ground, but when someone steps on them, they do. And this mine fragment that he had on his desk, he said, well, it had only been 3 days before that a group of children in a village nearby, young children, had found this mine, had picked it up, and were playing a game of tossing it back and forth in a circle until it finally blew up. One of the children dropped it. Two of the children were killed, and the three others were seriously wounded. This mine was a U.S.-made anti-personnel mine that had been dropped during the aerial bombings or aerial movement over Cambodia in 1974 and 1975. So here we were 20 years later, and they were still finding mines of this sort and killing and wounding children.
What's the state-of-the-art way to go about demining now?
Well, the state-of-the-art way of demining is primitive. It is today in most of the developing countries still a method which is by using a prod, which is simply a 12-inch prod, and a man or deminer will stay in front of with a mine detector, will move along an area, and when he or she finds a mine, will then step back, and their colleague will come forward usually on their stomach, an inch forward, and prod until they can actually expose the mine. And then they'll move on and keep down the line until they can find as many mines as they can in a day. Then at the end of the day, all of the mines are linked up with a common explosive and detonated at once. But what happens here is even though this, that you may have a situation where, as I remember a case in Cambodia, of Halo Trust, a mine clearance team there, sent out and worked for 6 weeks. And they had been told by local army officials that there were probably 600 to 700 mines in this area. They went and worked for 6 weeks, slowly prodding through the area, and they only turned up 4 mines. Now, it would have taken the same amount of time to find 600 as it would to find 4 or 5 mines in that area. So it's a very slow, painstaking process. And that's why it'll take many years in Cambodia and many years in Angola and all these other countries to finally lift them. Part of the problem is in the use of large machinery such as flails, which sort of pound the earth and destroy mines on contact. They often miss mines. And it's only by literally prodding every square inch or foot of the earth that you're going to find all of the mines and make the area clear.
How often can you see a mine if it's been planted someplace? Is it usually covered up or is it usually in the open?
Well, it depends on the types of mines. The pressure mines are usually camouflaged in some way, and they may be put under within 4 or 5 centimeters under the soil or a little deeper, or they may simply be placed in the grass. And what happens is over time and undergrowth grows over the mines and they're difficult to see. There is another type of mine known as the stake mine, and that is, though camouflaged, sticks up at least a foot above the ground, and you can see it, but it works on a tripwire mechanism, and the tripwire is very difficult to see. Oftentimes, even these mines will be used in trees, and the trip wires will be strung across the trees at about head level. There are also many pressure mines. There's a Japanese Type 72A mine, which is a very small mine, and it has an anti-tilt device. So even if it's left exposed, if someone comes along and actually touches the mine in any way and tilts it, there's a bead of mercury that runs and makes a contact, and it will explode.
Eric Stover is executive director of Physicians for Human Rights. That group collaborated with the Arms Project of Human Rights Watch on a new book called Landmines, A Deadly Legacy. Stephen Goose is Washington director of the Arms Project, which is also calling for a ban on landmines. He says one of the reasons for the global landmine crisis is that these weapons are accessible to poor countries and guerrilla groups.
More than anything else, it's because they're cheap and they're easy to use.
Mm-hmm.
We have discovered from our research that you can pick up Chinese landmines, for example, that are quite effective for about $3 per landmine. And these are fairly sophisticated plastic landmines that are hard to detect and that are very effective in blowing off people's feet and legs and arms.
How do the landmines of today compare to the mines that were used in, say, World War II?
A lot of the landmines that were used in World War II are still out there, first of all.
Right, and can still explode.
That's right.
Yeah.
There are still deaths every year in Poland and Libya and other places in Eastern and, for that matter, Western Europe, where landmines are still claiming victims. And a lot of the landmines that are being still produced today are not all that different from the technology of World War II. But having said that, there are also now very sophisticated mines. I mean, one of the very disturbing trends that we see with the global landmines crisis is the degree to which the mines that are being produced today are being made almost entirely of plastic. Some, indeed, are being made entirely of plastic, and these are extremely difficult to detect. They give the mine clearers tremendous problems.
So which countries are the biggest exporters of landmines? Is it the same countries that are the biggest manufacturers?
Yes, it is. We believe, again, looking over a number of years, that probably the former Soviet Union and China and Italy right at the top. What we're seeing with exports in particular is that a lot of developing nations are getting into the game. This is true both for production and export, that increasingly many third world nations are seeing this as a way of earning some foreign exchange dollars as well as getting involved in the international arms trade market in some way. So the countries like Pakistan and Egypt are now becoming important exporters. The same is true for Singapore. South Africa is likely to emerge as a major exporter now that it is having its embargoes lifted.
Are those countries that would be more difficult to discourage from exporting landmines?
Yes, they will be. There's no doubt that if you're going to have some kind of successful ban on landmines, it's going to have to be one that is a total ban. That is, that where both developed nations and developing nations come to believe that these weapons have to be treated as inhumane weapons of war. Otherwise, it will simply be a case of the third world nations seeing economic opportunities that have been abandoned by the developed world.
Stephen Goose is Washington director of the Arms Project of Human Rights Watch. That group has published a new book called Landmines, A Deadly Legacy. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Novelist E. Annie Prue doesn't like to talk about her past, but her characters are haunted by theirs, by the family histories that continue to shape their lives. Coming up, we talk with Prue about her work. This year, her fiction won the Penn Faulkner Award and the National Book Award. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, the new Fox Kids show. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The Clinton administration today sought to counter the impression that its health care reform plan is losing support among doctors. The president invited 10 supportive doctors' groups to the White House. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
A week after the most powerful doctors' lobby, the American Medical Association, backed away from the major financing mechanism of the White House plan, the president and first lady appeared at the White House surrounded by representatives of physicians' groups that endorsed their plan and its proposal to have employers pay for most of the cost of their employees' health care premiums. The 10 small groups represent gynecologists, pediatricians, internists, and family doctors. Together, the White House pointed out, they represent 300,000 physicians, making their collective membership just a hair bigger than the AMA's 296,000. White House officials admit that although they are equal in number to the AMA, the 10 small doctors' groups still don't have the lobbying clout of the Medical Association. But administration officials hope the endorsements they collected today send a message to lawmakers on Capitol Hill that the AMA does not speak for all American physicians. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
Less than 24 hours after Secretary of Defense Les Aspin announced that he was stepping down, President Clinton nominated retired Admiral Bobby Inman to take Aspin's place. Inman served as head of the National Security Agency during the Carter administration and as number two man at CIA during the Reagan years. Inman said that he accepted this nomination out of duty and did not seek the job. He also said that he had voted for former President Bush in last year's election. His appointment has to be confirmed by the Senate, and Senate GOP leader Bob Dole called Inman a very good person for the job. The value of UAL Corporation stock fell more than $4 a share today on the New York Stock Exchange. The board of UAL, parent company of United Airlines, met today to consider an employee proposal to acquire a majority stake in the air carrier. NPR's Cheryl Duvall reports.
The UAL board concluded its meeting Thursday by asking the unions behind the proposal and the company's investment advisors to present a comprehensive financial assessment of the acquisition plan at the board's next meeting on Wednesday. The offer, valued by United's pilots and machinists unions at $5 billion, includes a combination of preferred stocks, debt, cash, and wage and work rule concessions. Despite an improving financial picture this year, United reportedly embraced this proposal as a way to cut costs after several years of losses. The employee plan would allow United to experiment with new ways to compete with no-frills regional carriers, possibly by starting a low-fare subsidiary of its own. In Chicago, I'm Cheryl Duvall reporting.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 9 points to close at 3,726.14 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. Despite reports of a Christmas ceasefire between Croatian and Muslim groups in central Bosnia, UN officials said today that heavy Serb attacks continued. There have been local radio reports of a ceasefire from December 23rd until January 3rd, along with safe passage for a UN aid convoy to a besieged hospital. However, a number of ceasefires in the past have failed to take hold. There are also local news reports of continued fighting in Sarajevo. U.S. and Russian officials have signed a contract spelling out how Russians will join the International Space Station that NASA plans to build. This agreement also calls for a cosmonaut-astronaut exchange program. NPR's Richard Harris has that story.
Space officials fighting for funds to continue manned space programs in the United States and Russia hope that adding international cooperation between the former Cold War foes will build political support for these efforts. Phase one of the agreement signed in Moscow arranges for Russian cosmonauts to ride the space shuttle, American astronauts to ride Russian rockets, and eventually for the U.S. shuttle to visit the Russian space station. In phase two of the plan, Russia will make and launch laboratory modules, an escape pod, and a space tug. These will become part of the International Space Station that is supposed to be assembled in orbit starting in 1997. U.S. taxpayers will still provide most of the money to build and operate the space station, but Russian participation should make it get built about 2 years faster than its current schedule. This is Richard Harris in Washington.
In Moscow, officials are still counting votes after weekend elections. Officials say that there is no reason to suspect voter fraud. Some international election observers say that they are looking into rumors of possible irregularities. New results announced today from St. Petersburg gave a major boost to reformers. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. This year, Annie Proulx went from literary obscurity to literary fame. Her first novel, Postcards, which was published last year, won this year's Pen Faulkner Award. Her second novel, The Shipping News, won this year's National Book Award. Proulx may be a newcomer to novels, but she's no youngster. She's 58, has raised three sons, and most of her life struggled to make a living writing for magazines. Proulx lives in Vermont. Most of her latest novel, The Shipping News, is set in Newfoundland, where the main character writes a shipping news column for the local weekly paper. Before Proulx reads an excerpt, here's her description of the main character, Coyle.
Coyle, who was in his 30s when this story begins, is a lurching, out-of-sync, big, fat, heavy fellow who doesn't think well of himself and who just stumbles through life. And nothing works for him. It's as though he's on a one-way train to nowhere.
And why did you make him a big fat fellow?
I wanted him to be awkward. I wanted him to have that body bulk to handle in addition to his other problems. I wanted him not to fit in literally to the spaces that the rest of the world around him fit into. I just wanted him to be completely out of sync. And that was one way to do it.
Did you want him to ever lose weight?
No, I wanted him to come to grips with it, and with the people and the people around him to just take him for what he was. I didn't want him to turn into a Prince Charming at all, except in an interior sense and in terms of his own regard for his abilities and skills.
So let me ask you to read a passage from the beginning, not the very beginning, but a few pages in from the Shipping News, and you might want to set this up.
This is poor Coyle, who has everything in his life has gone wrong. His parents have committed suicide. His wife has run off and left him. His best friend has moved away. His children have been sold to a child pornographer. And here he is in this wretched town of Mockingburg, where he works, where he is about to find work as a third-rate newspaper man. Here's the description of Coyle at the beginning of the story. Coyle, stuck in bedraggled Mockingburg, a place in its third death, stumbled in 200 years from forests and woodland tribes to farms, to a working-class city of machine tool and tire factories. A long recession emptied the downtown, killed the malls, factories for sale, slum streets, youths with guns in their pockets, political word rattle of some litany, sore mouths and broken ideas. Who knew where the people went? Probably California. Coyle bought groceries at the A&B grocery, got his gas at the D&G convenience, took the car to the R&R garage when it needed gas or new belts. He wrote his pieces, lived in his rented trailer, watching television. Sometimes he dreamed of love. Why not? A free country. When Ed Punch fired him, he went on binges of cherry ice cream, canned ravioli. He abstracted his life from the Times. He believed he was a newspaper reporter, yet read no paper except the Mockingburg Record, and so managed to ignore terrorism, climatological change, collapsing governments, chemical spills, plagues, recession, and failing banks, floating debris, the disintegrating ozone layer, volcanoes, earthquakes, and hurricanes, religious frauds, defective vehicles, and scientific charlatans, mass murderers and serial killers, tidal waves of cancer, AIDS, deforestation, and exploding aircraft were as remote to him as braid catches, canyons, and rosette-embroidered garters. Scientific journals spewed reports of mutant viruses, of machines pumping life through the near dead, of the discovery that the galaxies were streaming apocalyptically toward an invisible great attractor, like flies into a vacuum cleaner nozzle. That was the stuff of others' lives. He was waiting for his to begin.
Well, that might give our listeners a sense of why you've been winning all these awards. That's pretty good. I want to just read a very brief description of his wife, the wife who has just left him and will soon be killed in a car crash. You describe her as, you say, at night she became a woman who could not be held back from strangers' rooms, who would have sexual conjunction whether in stinking restrooms or mop cupboards. Did you know women like her?
Do I personally know women like her?
Yeah.
Not many. I suppose that the wild sexual woman flies across everyone's vision from time to time. So, yes, I think in the past I've known women who were vaguely like Petal.
Tell me why you created her.
She was exactly what Coyle needed at this point in his life. I needed a really unhappy situation for him, and so I gave him this quicksilver, rather mad person who cared nothing for her children. And I just wanted to get Coyle with his kids off to Newfoundland, and Petal was the quickest way to do that.
Now, he works for, once he gets to Newfoundland, he starts to work on another weekly paper. Now, you've worked on weekly papers, right? Small-town weeklies?
I was involved with a small paper in Vermont called Behind the Times years ago. I started it, and it was actually a monthly rather than a weekly, but I've known a lot of people in my life who have worked on dailies, weeklies, that sort of thing. So I know a lot of newspaper people, and it's a wonderful way to cover a social situation, to use a newspaper in a book if you want to cover the events of the times. This is an excellent way to use it.
If you don't mind, I'm going to skip ahead to the very last sentence of the shipping news. And I don't think the sentence reveals very much in the way of plot. But the sentence is, "And it may be that love sometimes occurs without pain and misery." Is that something you've... hoped, or does that reflect anything on your experience?
My own personal experience?
Yeah.
Oh, no. I've always been marvelously happy. it's there because, again, this wretched Coyle who gets through life and somehow things work round for him. Well, actually, it goes back a little farther than that. Let me back up a bit. When I wrote The Postcards, which was my first novel, a lot of people came up to me and said, "Oh, I love that book, but it was so sad. It was just so painful." And I began to get the idea, I heard it enough times, I began to get the idea that people really wanted a happy ending. And so I thought to myself in a rather sardonic manner, "Happy ending, eh? All right, we'll do a book with a happy ending."
So that's the happiest you could come up with, the hope that perhaps there is happiness.
Well, for Coyle, this is a happy ending, the absence of pain.
Right.
But the story is worked out in such a way that the reader is not conscious that it isn't really a happy ending. People accept it as a happy ending, even though it's a very modest happiness.
My guest is Annie Prue, her novel The Shipping News won this year's National Book Award. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with novelist Annie Prue. Now, your first novel, Postcards, that's the one that won the Penn Faulkner Award,
yes,
Award earlier this year.
Correct.
Describe for us how Postcards figure into the novel.
Postcards were a device, and they preface each section. There is a handwritten postcard from one character or another that carries a short personal message, but also moves the story along in a way. And the reason I used those postcards was, one, to involve the reader in the book, because everybody loves to read postcards. It pulls the reader into the story and makes the reader fill in between the lines with imagining the characters. And the second reason was because I had a lot of different places in this book. It really is a march across North America. And the postcards were one way of getting that geographical span to work. It also allowed me to move between different voices and different periods of time very economically. The whole book is laid out in 4 decades, so that we move from the 1940s to the contemporary period. And we do it a little subtly by, or indicate the time changes subtly by using the postcards with different dates.
Was there an incident that got you thinking about postcards?
Oh, years ago, someone had given me a handful of postcards that were that featured the pictures, the photographs of prisoners on one side and a description of their crimes on the other. These were escapees from the then Vermont State Prison, and they were extremely fascinating to me, just these mug shots, and I carried them around with me for a long time, maybe 8 or 10 years before I even started to think of writing a novel. They were just something that was extremely interesting to me, and then it just popped into my head when I started to write this novel that those postcards were very powerful. And while I never used them, I never used prison escapee postcards, I did use the postcards proper.
I've never heard of prison escapee postcards before.
Probably something that only happened in Vermont and only for a short period.
Who were they mailed to?
I think they went to the sheriffs in each county. I think a packet of them would be stuffed in an envelope. I don't think they went out singly through the mails openly and naked. I think a bunch of them were shoved into an envelope and sent to local sheriffs, be on the watch for these fellows.
So how did you make a living before you started earning a living as a writer?
Well, I didn't make a living before I started earning a living as a writer. I went back to school when I was in my late 20s to study history and did graduate work at Sir George Williams in Montreal, which is now Concordia University, and promptly found myself, when I finished that, decided I didn't want to be an historian, but I found myself absolutely unable to get a job. I was overqualified for everything in the state of Vermont. I kept applying and applying, so I ended up with lousy jobs of slinging hash or working in pizza joints, this kind of thing, because I couldn't get a job for which I was qualified. And at that point, I started writing. I was living up north near the Canadian border, and I started writing. It was a way that I could make some money and exist.
Were you already a mother then?
Oh, yeah. Sure.
So did you usually not have a whole lot of money when you were raising your kids?
I did not have a whole lot of money when I was raising my kids, that's for sure. I've never had a whole lot of money. But so what? Most people don't.
Right. It sounds like you, in fact, though, had very little.
There were times in my life when I had very little, yes. There was a period in my life when I was living with a friend on the Canadian border, when we spent a lot of time hunting and gathering and fishing. That was a real eye-opener, very interesting way to live.
How did you get by easily with it?
No, you don't get by easily doing it that way. You spend an enormous amount of time in pursuit of food.
Have you often been considered the town eccentric where you've lived?
No. I can't think why I would be.
Oh, okay.
This is Vermont.
Meaning?
Vermont has lots of town eccentrics. And when I was doing this back-to-nature trip, I was up on the Canadian border. I was in a very, very rural place. And most Vermont towns that I've lived in, I've been in a very rural situation where you don't have nearby neighbors who watch your comings and goings and so forth.
Now that you've gotten all these awards this year, are you nervous about writing? Do you feel that there's something you're supposed to be living up to now, that your work will be judged differently? It's easy to lose your equilibrium after something like that.
Right. Well, my work may indeed be judged differently, but since I don't know any different way to write, I'll just have to go ahead doing it the way I've always done it. It's because my interest in the lives of my characters has always been greater than in my own life or remembering details of my life, I don't think there's going to be a problem. I'm absolutely wild to get back to work on that book, on Accordion Crimes.
Maybe that's what you just said is an obvious thing for anybody who writes fiction, but why are your characters' lives more interesting to you than your own memories?
I have no idea. I haven't the slightest clue. They just are. I spend almost no time brooding over my own past or thinking on past incidents. I forget my past at once as soon as it's happened, unless I'm forced into a corner and made to remember it. It's just not interesting to me.
Is that a good thing? I mean, so much of us are almost morbidly self-involved and are always analyzing our past and how it's affecting our present and what our parents did when they were bringing us up and so on. Is it liberating to not be thinking about that?
I think so. It seems so to me. I'd really much rather put the energy and keenness into making these paper characters. How to describe it? It's like having an enormous and tremendously difficult crossword puzzle in front of you, and the finishing of this crossword puzzle can take a year or two. And writing a novel to me is like going daily to that puzzle and working it and rearranging it. Crossword puzzle isn't a very good comparison. But one's own life, I mean, it has already happened. You can't rearrange the events of the past the way you can rearrange a novel.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you, Terry.
Annie Prue is the author of Postcards and The Shipping News. She spells her last name Proulx. This is Fresh Air. President Clinton has nominated Bobby Inman to be the new Secretary of Defense. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what will you have on this nomination on All Things Considered?
First of all, Terry, who he is, and then what he faces around the world and the little landmines that are waiting for him around the Pentagon. Also, Brooke Gladstone will explain who holds the balance of power in the Russian elections. The democracy survey, a democracy survey out today, says that democracy is on the decline in the world. We summoned a conference of our foreign correspondents, three women who cover Eastern Europe, Asia, and Africa for us to discuss that. There have been some developments in the Packwood case. We'll have your letters and Chef Guillaume.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Every few years, a new children's TV show comes along that suddenly and unexpectedly becomes the hot new thing among the younger set. Don't look now, but it's happened again. And when TV critic David Bianculli says, don't look now, he means it literally.
I get about 10 videotapes a day that people want me to look at. The networks, cable, syndicators, they all send them. Well, one day a few years ago, I open up the Federal Express package, and there's not only a tape, there's a box of candy. You know those chewy chocolate caramel cluster thingies? Well, there was a box of those in there, along with a tape of a brand new cartoon show. It was about four pizza-eating, karate-chopping reptiles. And I gotta tell you, I was a lot more impressed by the candy than by the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Who knew? But it's happening again, with a new Fox children's show called Mighty Morphin Power Rangers. In just a few months, this new show is shot to the top of the kids' TV ratings, watched by more kids than any other daytime show. I can't believe this, because Mighty Morphin Power Rangers is awful. I mean, really, really awful. I'd call it the worst series made in America right now, except that most of it isn't made in America. It's made in Japan. The parts shot in America are about five L.A. teenagers with secret superpowers. When they get in trouble or want to stop a bad guy, They scream out their dinosaur code names and turn into weird-looking android-type people with brightly colored bodysuits and goofy-looking motorcycle helmets. And then they fight.
Mastodon!
Pterodactyl!
Triceratops!
Saber-tooth tiger!
Tyrannosaurus!
Oh! Yeah!
The main reason these kids mutate is so the producers of Power Rangers can fill the rest of the show with action footage from the original Japanese TV series. Behind the helmets, you can't tell the stunt doubles are Japanese, and all the creatures they fight are hidden behind tacky masks. All of them except for Rita Repulsa, a Japanese woman who plays an evil witch. You're going to have to imagine this on the radio, but trust me, you haven't seen overdubbing this bad since What's Up, Tiger Lily. And the special effects make Doctor Who look like Jurassic Park.
The buddies are ready, Your Highness!
Good! Those insolent little brats are going to get exactly what they deserve!
Yeah.
Take the monster down to Earth, hidden in the lamp, and not even Zordon will know
he's
there! Now send those two down to Earth, Logan!
Yes, my queen!
Right!
Horrible as this sounds, it gets worse. At some point during every show, the five Power Rangers come up against a creature so formidable they have to change or morph yet again. This time they combine forces and turn into a five-piece giant robot, kind of like a 15-story Mr. Machine. Then they do battle, stomping around some cardboard city set in scenes that look like they were rejected from Mothra vs. Godzilla. The point of all this, of course, is to sell the toys. The action figures of the Power Rangers, as well as the five individual parts that make up the mechanical super creature. The salesmanship is as shameless and obvious as the dubbing and editing, and it's working. The kids are watching the show and loving it and begging for the toys as Christmas presents, so much so that stores can't stock enough of them to sell. If there were truth and justice in children's TV, Mighty Morphin Power Rangers would be given another title, each sold separately.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Nancy Greenlease and Peter Clowney. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. Pinch hitting for our director today was director emeritus Chris Spurgeon. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies, with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3393. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Raphael Scharf has spent his life documenting the Holocaust. Most of his family died in the Auschwitz death camp, which was very near his home. On the next Fresh Air, after we hear Scharf's story, we'll talk with historian Deborah Lipstadt about a chilling trend in historical revisionism, denying the Holocaust ever happened. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.